And that's like basic like hot tub or pool chemistry, right? If your pH goes too low, you're going to generate a lot more bromine from your – those of you who have worked at a pool shop know this. If your pH is too low, you consume your hydantoin way, way faster. So that makes a lot of sense to me, actually.
I see like a hot tub flow time machine movie in the works potentially. I don't know.
Hi, I'm LC, and I'm a storyteller. I'm a passionate chemist who loves to explore and tell stories about how chemistry can change the world.
And I'm Danny, and I'm LC's spirited chemistry co-host. I love to bring high energy and positivity to my chemistry, but also my life. Welcome to the Farm to Table podcast.
We're two chemists working at the pharmaceutical company Merck in the U.S.,
also known as MSD, everywhere else in the world except Canada, the U.S., and its territories.
And this is a podcast where we'll tell you stories about the people and the science behind the papers published by our chemistry group.
Each week, we'll pick one to two papers that we recently published and introduce you to the key people behind it, and also ask them to give you a unique insight into the story behind it.
So welcome, everyone. Today, we're here to talk with François Lévesque and Cecilia Bottecchia to talk about flow chemistry and specifically about visible light-induced bromination, which was actually recently published in OPR&D. You both received the Peter Dunn Award in Green Chemistry last year, along with your teammates John McMullen and Steve Dalby on this. So congrats on that, and welcome to the podcast.
Welcome. Congrats.
Thanks, Elsie.
Thank you.
Thanks, Danny.
Cecilia, you are a second-time visitor on the pod. We had a snack where we kind of highlighted your Peter Dunn Award as well. But in case listeners had not caught that episode, which they should, we would like you to introduce yourself again. So who are you? What do you do at Merck? And maybe an interesting fun fact.
Absolutely. First of all, thank you so much for having me again. So my name is Cecilia Bottecchia. I was born and raised in Italy, in Milano. I studied there up until undergrad, and then I did my PhD in the Netherlands in the group of Professor Timothy Noel. And so I already had some flow experience there. And finally, in 2019, I moved to the US to work here at Merck. I'm currently an associate principal scientist in the flow chemistry group. So it's mostly what I've been doing the past 3 years is indeed flow chemistry. I like to say that in Merck years, I'm a toddler. I'm 3 years old because, you know, there's so many experienced people, many scientists that I've been working with here, which has been amazing. Something fun. Well, what I like to do for fun is skiing. So I'm a big skier. This year, I finally got to go out west to ski in Utah, which, you know, was fantastic. And I very much look forward to kind of like explore all the skiing destinations in the U.S. So I'm going to need a couple more winters for that for sure.
Very nice. I would like to say for all of our listeners, congrats on your promotion. Cecilia was just promoted this week. So that's very
exciting.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Francois, how about you? Do you want to tell us a little bit about your story?
Yeah. So I was born in Quebec, in Canada. I did my PhD in organic chemistry at the University of Sherbrooke. Then I decided to move to a different country. So I moved to Germany to join the group of Peter Zeeberger at the Max Planck Institute in Berlin. This is where I started to do some flow chemistry. So, and I worked on multiple projects, but I guess the key highlight of my stay there was the synthesis of artemisinin, which is a treatment for malaria. And then I started to move around a little bit. I worked in Canada for a few years. Then I moved to Belgium in Brussels, where I've worked also doing flow chemistry. And one day I got a phone call from LC and he was starting a flow group. So, and I guess I couldn't say no to that opportunity. And I moved to New Jersey around 6.5 years ago. And I've always been in the flow group since then and did pretty cool chemistry. So I'm happy about that decision of moving to Merck.
What is a fun fact?
Ooh, fun
you
fact.
You got to deliver that.
Can I say it too?
Yeah.
So I'm Canadian. So, and I noticed that I had four maple trees in my backyard. So 3 years ago, I decided to tap them, and since then, I've been making maple syrup in my kitchen.
What?
And it's really good.
I cannot believe I did not know this.
Yeah,
I need to try
half
your
a gallon
maple syrup.
This year. It was a really good one. Really good year this year. And I'm on a quest to climb all the 4,000 footer in the Northeast. So in New Hampshire, I have 40 out of 48. So getting really close to that magic number. So and now I'm working in the Catskill, so which is very close to here.
Okay, let's dive into the topic of our podcast, which is your very cool photochemical bromination. Cecilia, can you tell us a little bit more about this project, how it came to be, and why we decided to explore flow for it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, let's try to discuss a little bit what was the chemistry, what were we trying to do here? So imagine, you know, we have our synthetic intermediate, a highly functionalized molecule, many other functional groups, and there's a benzylic position that we were trying to functionalize with a bromide. And so there was a pre-existing route to make this intermediate, and this was going through a radical bromination. I think most people might be familiar with this type of reactions. They might have seen it in you know, textbook examples, where often we see radical brominations with NBS, for example, with light or with, in general, any other radical initiator. So the previous route really relied on this radical system where the radical generation was initiated with AIBN. So this is a thermal initiator, essentially is some sort of a diazo compound that loses nitrogen and generates a carbon central radical. However, there were some issues with the pre-existing route, some things that we didn't like. And first and foremost, the reaction was run in DCM, which is a chlorinated solvent that we did not want to use on scale. This AIBN or any other similar compounds actually have some handling issues. They're not very easy to move around the world. And most importantly, the reaction showed some instability. I think we're going to discuss a little bit more into detail where that instability came from. But really, the idea here became, can we use light to trigger this reaction and move away from these thermal radical initiators? And obviously, when you think about running a reaction with light, then sort of immediately you think about, am I going to be running this in flow? Hmm. So this is how the story started.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, to give our audience maybe some perspective, you know, a lot of radical initiators, they're designed to break apart at low temperatures, which makes them great in reactions, but makes them pretty terrible to ship around the world because they are unstable. And we don't really think about how temperatures can change in shipping, right? It's something that process chemists have to think about. Can you elaborate a little bit on the chlorinated solvents thing? So, you know, we know this, we don't like to use chlorinated solvents, but, you know, a lot of radical brominations really only work in chlorinated solvents. Was that even avoidable just with the radical initiator or were we stuck with that?
It seemed like we were stuck with that. So, for example, using the thermal initiator route, so the IBN route, was not giving us the possibility to really use any other solvent. And this was something that we couldn't fix in any ways. And so once we started looking at this reaction with light, it became apparent that we also had better solvent options. Mm. And so we could run this reaction in acetonitrile, which was not only a better solvent, but also the solvent used in the following step of this synthesis. And so that made it possible to even avoid the isolation of our product and just carry forward the reaction into the next step.
Great. Well, before we dive into this a little bit deeper, we have a few clips that we're going to play for you from Dan DiRocco, who's a member of our process chemistry team and who really started a lot of the flow, a lot of the photochemistry at Merck, like, you know, before the flow group even existed. So we'll play you a few clips of sort of the initial steps in that process, and then we'll come back and continue our discussion here.
We were able to build photoreactors in-house, 3D printing and other machining allowed us to make things that were scalable to about 100 grams in the lab. And so we did a lot of development work on that oxidation reaction on that scale. And then as it progressed and the program progressed, we knew we had to build something that with an eye towards manufacturing. And that's when we built this sort of large fish tank type reaction, which I believe was about 4 liters internal volume of about a mile of PFA tubing. So it was a very long run of tubing, had a lot of, a couple kilowatts worth of LEDs around it. But the fish tank allowed us to control the temperature pretty well.
All right. So Francois, I think it's safe to say that, you know, we've come a long way since this first photo flow that Dan described, that first prototype. Can you highlight how our enabling technology strategy has evolved in investing in these types of capabilities in order to enable speed when we need them? And, you know, for this project, I think that was particularly true because we had a pretty short runway to do that. Can you tell us a little bit about how the flow group operates even before this process, you know, arrived in our shop?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, like, as you're pointing out, if we want to implement a technology, a new technology in a process, especially when you have a very short and rapid paced project, we need to have, like, pre-invested in that technology. And there's two main reasons for that. So first of all, we need to have some internal knowledge about that technology. For example, photochemistry, how do we scale up photochemistry? But we also need to have the equipment to perform those type of transformation. So even though we would know, if we don't have the equipment to perform that, then it's difficult. And the key is always to have this essential, solid proof of concept that allows us to say, okay, we're confident that we can move forward and move to the plant and use this technology in the process. And I wanted to share a little story. Like, I feel like the LED technology that we have been using for this process have evolved a lot. So I remember going to the equivalent of a Radio Shack in Germany around 2010 to buy my first LED. It was, I think, 1 watt, maybe two. And it worked, but it was not very powerful. So since then, I think the technology evolved a lot, and there's LED everywhere. You can select the wavelength that you want, and that's great for us photochemists.
So what kind of power do we typically use in our reactors for LEDs to give people a sense of that difference?
Yeah, so I just mentioned 2 watt. Now a chip is 100 watt, and we'll use multiple chips. So the reactor that we built can go up to 1,000 watt.
Wow.
on each side of the reactor. So quite rapidly you can pump in a lot of photons into your reaction.
So basically, LEDs have evolved. Radio Shack has devolved. I don't even think people don't even know what Radio Shack is. Probably, like, our listeners probably have no idea. But
oh, sorry guys. So yeah, you're that's a very good point, Danny. So yeah, a lot of evolution on the LED front.
All right, so we have LEDs.
So we have the LEDs that allow us to add some photons. The other thing that was very key to our discovery was the scale-up parameter. So and that was some work that was done in collaboration with Emily Corcoran, who is now in DPC Boston. And one of the key questions that we were asking ourselves at that time was, what is this parameter that would allow us to scale photochemistry? And we looked at a bunch of different parameters, light power, volume of the reactor, resonance time, name it. And nothing really aligned until we looked at conversion and function of photon equivalent, and that was key. Once you're plotting your conversion and function of photon equivalent, everything starts to line up. And we knew that from that scale-up parameter, we would be able to transfer from one scale to the other. And that was published in Angavante a few years ago in 2019. So now that we know that the reaction conversion is dictated by the number of photons that we're putting in the reaction, then we can start to build reactor that have the ability to deliver a lot of photons. And Dan mentioned a pretty large scale photoreactor, but we thought that we could minimize the size of that unit and be able to, using those high power LED, to deliver the same amount of photons that they were using for the very large reactor. So again, I got inspired going around. So I was buying some fish with my son at a pet shop, and I saw a 5.5 gallon fish tank, and I was like, that would be perfect. So if we could fit our photoreactor in that space, then we would have like the perfect size reactor to scale up photochemistry. So bought that fish tank, built some light panels. One of the key things that we notice with those light panels is the photon density is so high that there's a lot of heat. So you need to be able to remove that heat that is coming from those LEDs. So we mounted those LED on panels that were liquid cool. So we're recirculating water through those to maintain the temperature at lower temperature. And in the end, we were able to build that photoreactor, which is 20 times smaller than the reactor that Dan mentioned, and it's 50% more powerful than the previous generation reactor.
Yeah, there's a few things I want to pull on here. One, the photon equivalence paper is awesome. It's super easy to go through and to do that math. And so I encourage our listeners to check that out if they're interested. And then also to help folks understand like the difference in size, it's basically what, going from the size of a refrigerator to a fish tank, kind of? That's maybe 20 times?
Yeah, so the previous reactor, it's almost taller than me.
Wow.
And the fish tank, I can put it in my hands.
Yeah.
So I can lift that reactor. And it's very important because when you think about it, looking forward, in a plant, there's limited space. So the ability to have a very small reactor was essential. And that allowed us to convince a lot of people that it was a technology that we could use on much larger scale.
Awesome. Okay, it sounds like we have the reactor, we have the project Chichilia. Can you describe how you even start to put all of these pieces together and develop a reaction like this? Walk us through, I guess, the discovery and the optimization process, please.
Sure. So I guess in terms of discovery, it's a little bit of a funny story here. So, right, we knew we wanted to look at the use of light to trigger this reaction, to initiate. But we thought, we reasoned, you know, what we have to activate is our brominating agent, which in this case was dibromodimethyledantoin, very similar to NBS as type of reagent. And so we measured the absorption spectrum, and it absorbs in the UV light. And so, obviously, we start irradiating our reaction mixture with a UV lamp. And in terms of UV LEDs, there hasn't been as much of a progress as for example, blue LED or visible light LEDs. So we had these 365 nanometers LEDs that we were using, but we also had this very strange looking lamp that is actually a 312 nanometer wavelength, which we thought was pretty much what we needed. And it's a lamp that is actually used for some skin treatment. So it's used for psoriasis. And when we used that lamp, the reaction worked beautifully. Very neat conversion, one peak of starting material disappearing, one peak of product forming. But what we also noticed at that stage was how the reaction was turning orange over time. So it started out as a clear solution and then became orange. And obviously that got us thinking, wait a minute, what are we forming here? Could it be that we're actually forming bromine? And bromine is the absorbing species in our reaction mixture. So again, we went back and measured absorption spectra. So that indeed, it was very likely that we had bromine in there. But that also meant, wow, we can now use visible light instead of a UV lamp. And indeed, when we tried the reaction with blue light, we had very similar conversion, very high yields, very clean reaction profile.
Very interesting. To dive a little bit more deeper, the paper describes the use of LED NMR to study the reaction conditions. Can you explain what exactly this is and what the key findings were that kind of came out of this work?
Certainly. So I must say, first of all, that the development of this LED NMR technology was the awesome work by our co-workers, Yining and Misha, our colleagues. And so what they developed is essentially a way for us to run a reaction, a photochemical reaction, while the reaction is in the NMR, and so to really monitor in real time what's happening. And so the light is delivered to the inside of an NMR tube with an optical fiber, and then you're really monitoring, irradiating from the inside and monitoring what's happening. And so, for example, in this case, what we noticed was this higher level of control we had was essentially given by the fact that we could simply turn on and off the reaction by the flick of a switch. So if you turn off the light, reaction stops. And so if you're trying to stop your reaction at the moment in time where you have the highest possible yield and very little side products, all you do is turn off the light. This was simply not possible with the thermal process, where you have these radicals, you know, running around in your reaction because you created them by decomposing your initiator. And then the only way for you to really stop the reaction is to rapidly cool down. And so this doesn't work very well when you have a huge reactor and you're trying to do this on scale. It's not that quick, the possibility to stop the reaction.
Absolutely not. That could take like a day to almost cool down a reactor if you think about it. The LED NMR also just says it's super cool. You can probably buy all of the parts on Amazon, not Radio Shack. Again, it's very easy to get your hands on that stuff. And we can drop the paper in the comments once we post the episode.
Yeah, I think that's a really good lesson for our listeners is like everything that you think only takes a few seconds or a few minutes when you do it in the lab can literally take hours or even days when you do it on scale. And God forbid you're doing a workup with an emulsion. So just a lesson learned there for a lot of folks. Okay. Another thing that's in the paper that I thought would be interesting to discuss is the impact of impurities on this reaction, right? So particularly yeah. metals. And in the paper, you talk about this. And I was wondering if you could talk us a little bit through that process and particularly why we were worried about copper contamination.
Yes, absolutely. So there's two things that happened through the course of the development of the process. At one point, we noticed that some batches of the product that was coming from the previous step was somewhat dark. And when you have a dark reaction mixture, it means that something in that reaction mixture is absorbing light and it was not going in the right direction. It was not helping us push the reaction forward. So it was just like, in the end, the way to look at it, if you have something else that is absorbing photons, it's not promoting your reaction. So to handle that, we decided to implement a carbon treatment that was removing all the colored impurity that were coming from the previous step. So that was also to improve the robustness of that. The other thing that, and you mentioned that, some copper impurity. So there was a change in the previous step that involved the use of copper. And what we noticed is when we received the initial batch of that material, the reaction was just slower. And in fact, like when they were performing the reaction using the thermal initiator, the reaction was not going to completion in that specific case. And we knew that the reaction was the previous reaction was using copper. And by doing some analysis, we noticed that it was only 10 ppm of copper. And even that small amount had impact on our chemistry. The good thing is, since we're using photons, we're always restarting the reaction. So it was slower, but it was still going. That being said, we wanted to have something more rapid, more robust. So we started to look into different type of additive that could trap that copper. So we initially looked at EDTA. It didn't do much to the reaction. And then we got the catalysis group engaged and see if they could screen different type of additive to accelerate the reaction. And one that we found was citric acid. Initially, we were thinking that citric acid was trapping copper, but in fact, it was converting the brominating agent into bromine. And we were just like generating bromine right away as soon as we added citric acid. And that was key to the development of this fast reaction and robust process.
So is it fair to say that in our attempt to solve the copper problem, we just accelerated a different part of the reaction, which ultimately solved the problem a different way? Is that accurate? Or did we still have to solve?
Exactly.
Okay. And that's like basic like hot tub or pool chemistry, right? If your pH goes too low, you're going to generate a lot more bromine from your those of you who have worked at a pool shop know this. If your pH is too low, you consume your hydantoin way, way faster. So that makes a lot of sense to me, actually.
I see like a hot tub flow time machine movie in the works potentially. I don't know. Okay, we're getting close to the end here, so let's try to wrap this up and hit home some of the main points. Cecilia, can you please walk us through the scale-up of this reaction in the pilot plant? So big, big scale. The paper describes a 50-kilo batch. Can you walk our listeners through what this looks like on scale? Maybe help us describe like how big the vessels are, the volumes of solvent that you're using, how long it takes, all of that good stuff.
Sure. So I'd like to start by describing the reactor a little bit. And so I actually want you to imagine a giant Oreo cookie.
Great.
Right? So imagine this is a diameter of almost 1 meter, something on that size. And so there are two glass frames, which would be the cookies in these metaphors. And this is sort of the reactor housing. But the reactor itself is somewhat the filling of the Oreo, right? It sits in between these two glass frames. And there's the ability to put, you know, cooling liquid in touch with the reactor, so you're actively cooling it as this is coiled inside. The light panels are actually then on the outside of the cookie, one on each side, and there's multiple LEDs on it. And this might be somewhat different than, you know, other reactors that maybe you've seen published in the literature, where typically the lamp is at the center and then there's a coil around it. In terms of volume, we're talking about around 1 liter, so actually not that different from the fish tank itself. Now, how do you use this in the plant? So essentially, you would have a very large vessel where you have prepared your solution, and you're going to start pumping from the vessel through the reactor where the irradiation happens, and then out, collecting into another large, very large vessel, where then you will have your product solution. And something interesting that actually not many people discuss is how when you're running reactions in flow, you kind of have the luxury of experimenting at scale. And what I mean with this is, for example, for this chemistry, we did a so-called engineering batch. So this is sort of like a 50-kilo experiment where you are changing, you know, the light intensity, the flow rate, the temperature you're operating at as you go through your 50 kilos, right? And then you pull samples as they come out of the reactor and really map out the operating space for that chemistry. What are the most important parameters that affect your conversion and your yield? And ultimately, for this chemistry, we really saw that it was extremely robust and we had a very broad and safe operating space.
Wow, that's pretty cool. It's like a way to do like DOE on the fly almost.
Yeah, kind of, yeah. And you wouldn't be doing that in batch, right? You cannot do multiple 50 kilo batches just to test the one parameter change.
Yeah, how many did we do? 80 reaction within a day?
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
On scale.
How long does it take to flow 50 kilos of batch through that 1 liter reactor? Like, give me a sense of like the reaction time.
I think the processing time for this was 20 hours, something on that ballpark figure.
Okay. Okay. So basically done in a day.
On day's work.
All in a day's work. All right. So one last question, François. In the paper, there was a quote that stood out to me where you say, "We expect that the photochemical renaissance of the past 10, 15 years will now pay dividends in the utilization of this technology in the manufacture of APIs." So can you give our listeners a sense of what you think the future will bring and what are the other kinds of photochemical reactions that you and your team have been working on in recent years?
Yeah, great question, Elsie. So I think one of the first thing is with photons, you are able to bring a lot of energy to your molecule. And it's energy that you transmit directly to your molecule. And that allows us to make reactions that are just impossible under thermal condition. And one good example is the maleic anhydride ethylene 2+2 cycloaddition that we published. That was in 2018. But I think that's a really good example. Cyclobutane are difficult to make otherwise. So using photons is a great way to do that. I think there's so many examples of photoredox. One will come our way at one point, and we're ready to tackle those type of transformation. What I think it's very attractive for those type of radical-centered carbon is they won't interact with amines or alcohol. So you can implement those reactions at a very late stage without the use of protecting group. And we see more and more of those polycyclic peptide across our pipeline. So I think like those type of transformation are perfect for that. And then the last one I want to mention is a reaction that Cecilia worked on a year ago, and it involves like the combination of two gases for the synthesis of a key intermediate, and that allowed us to drop the cost of that intermediate. And what is very amazing from my point of view is there's just no waste. You combine those two gases, and for the listeners that are aware, the PMI is very close to one. But I guess like you'll need to invite us again if you want to air more detail about that reaction.
Nice, a little teaser. I like that. I like that a lot.
So thanks again for coming on the pod. It was a blast to learn about, you know, process chemistry improvements within the photo flow world. So congratulations on all of your successes here, and we hope to have you back on.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It was so much fun.
Yeah. Thank you.
Cheers, folks.
Thanks for listening to the Farm to Table podcast. This would not have been possible without our fabulous producer, Mark Partridge, and listeners like you. Be sure to check our episode credits, where you'll find more details about the show, as well as links to anything that we've discussed during the show.
If you find yourself craving even more info, you can find us both on Twitter. I am at Danny the Chemist, and LC can be found at Dr. LC Squared. But of course, our show also has a handle, and that is at Farm to Table Pod. Farm with a PH, in case you were wondering, where you'll find some behind-the-scenes action, future episodes and sneak peeks, and likely some random posts about chemistry, snacks, and whatever else.
Of course, we'd love to hear from you, so please interact with us on Twitter. Feel free to post any chemistry papers, Merck chemistry papers, that you found particularly memorable and that maybe you want us to build an episode around.
So stay tuned, folks.